Hello, friends, and welcome to World Build With Us, the podcast where we create fantastical worlds with help from you, our listeners. My name is Rob Hilferny, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Daniel Quinn and Courtney Staples. On today's episode, we have a fresh springtime jam for you all. Where we roll some random dice and figure out some settings on our own. But before we get into that, before we get into anything, before we even get into the shilling, before we get into today's episode, I would like to stop and say, hey, World Build With Us listeners, first of all, thank you very much for listening. And perhaps most importantly, this is a major announcement that for the foreseeable future, World Build With Us will be going to a bi-weekly schedule. With everything going on in the world, everything going on with our lives, recording every week is just currently not feasible for us. I'm hoping that we get to come back to a weekly schedule at some point. However, for the foreseeable future, we will be going to a bi-weekly schedule. And on top of that, we are also announcing a listener survey. So if you are truly heartbroken about the bi-weekly schedule, or if you want to voice any opinion that you have with us about the projects that we do, hey, guess what? We've got your survey here where we can hear your voices. You can explain and tell us what your favorite parts about World Build With Us are. You can explain what's working for you, what's not working for you, and answer a bunch of other survey questions to help us make you a better podcast. A link for that is going to be in the show notes of this very episode, and we'll be running that for the next couple of weeks, probably. Or maybe we'll leave it open. Who knows, right? But if you are interested in leaving us feedback, especially if you're a patron, I would encourage you to go and do the survey that's in the description. So with all of that major announcement out of the way, let's go ahead and dive into the episode. Well, we're going to dive into the shilling now. So I would always like to remind everyone that if you want us to build your world, you can always go to our website, worldbuildwithus.com, where you can click the link, follow some instructions, and within a reasonable amount of time, we'll be building your world. If you want to follow us on social media, you can subscribe to us on YouTube or follow us at Twitter. At Twitter, we're a little different. It's at Let's World Build, but everything else, World Build With Us. Apparently, World Build With Us, too long for Twitter. So, you know, get fucked, Elon Musk. Anyway, if you want to talk to us more directly, we've got a Discord where you can chat with us about everything from jam to world building to really whatever you want. There's a link for that in the description. And of course, if you're feeling particularly generous or just want access to sweet, sweet patron-only goodies, you can give us money over on Patreon and support the podcast. With all of that out the way, let's dive right into the jam. So if this is your first jam with us, first of all, welcome. So glad to have you here. And the way that this works is that we roll some dice, figure out the genre, the theme, and the focus, and then build a setting or start to build a setting based on those randomized rolls. Now, courtesy of Daniel, we actually have an updated subgenre list. So we're going to have more than just the 19 that we currently do. And I'm very excited to see how this works out. I'm excited to see how this gets integrated. And without further ado, let's go ahead and roll for the genre. And the genre that we're dealing with is, we've got soft sci-fi. So having a little bit of trouble in the bedroom, that means that we've got soft sci-fi. Daniel, would you care to explain soft sci-fi just a little bit more for us, please?
So this genre's soft sci-fi is probably best described in contrast with hard sci-fi. So hard sci-fi is something like The Martian, where there's a strict adherence to how science works, and you don't do anything that's impossible by known science. Whereas soft sci-fi has a lot more leeway, and we're interested a bit in the imaginative and what's beyond the known. So things like light speed are totally possible. I would say something like Star Trek strives to appear like hard sci-fi, but it's really soft. And on the farthest end from hard would be something like Star Wars, where it's almost fantasy. And so,
yeah, I've always understood Star Wars as a sci fantasy.
Yeah, and that's another way to describe it, I would say.
Gotcha. Okay, well, thank you for that description, Daniel, truly. Besides the genre, we of course have the theme. And the theme that we're working with this time is going to be Oh, we got a nat 20, which means our theme is death. Okay. So we've got soft sci-fi, a theme of death. And the first thing that we're going to be focusing on, which is going to be a moment of triumph. So, Daniel, you gave us the genre explanation, so it's only fair that we make Courtney come up with her first idea for this thing. So what are you thinking, Courtney? We got soft sci-fi. We got death. So no rigor mortis there, obviously. And we've got a moment of triumph. What are we thinking about?
Yeah, the first thing that came to mind for me was somehow like crossing into the plane of death to potentially save somebody in a moment of triumph or stop death itself or something to that effect. Like the idea of crossing over to this frontier that has never been crossed before.
Ooh, wait. Are you kind of suggesting that this is the moment in time where we've conquered death as a species in some way? And like, that could be kind of cool, actually.
It could be something like that. Yeah. I would say either that, like we have figured out how to stop death, or we've figured out how to cross over into that realm and like contact those that are beyond now.
It makes me think of what was the movie, Flatliners? They experimented with killing themselves to understand the other side.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. I don't remember anything about it besides the like, heart paddles and them like inducing clinical death to experiment with the other side.
Is that the one that has John Goodman in it? Or is that something else?
No idea. It's a very 80s, late 80s movie, I think. About early 90s.
1990.
There you go. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Right on. So does it have John Goodman in it, though? That's what I want to know.
I am not seeing John Goodman on this list.
Well, damn. All right. Oh, I'm thinking about that Nicolas Cage movie that has John Goodman as like an ambulance driver or something like that. But we're getting far off topic here. So we've got death. We've got this idea that perhaps we've conquered death or are able to reach into the realm of death. Now, what I think might be really interesting about that, and you'll excuse my history nerd shit showing, but the idea that we could actually speak to the dead to a certain extent would completely like recontextualize how we approach world history. And I think that that's really cool because it also reminds me of Isaac Clarke's, one of the Clarks, Childhood's End, where, you know, aliens basically give humans the ability to look at all of Earth's history.
Arthur C. Clarke.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you. Jeez. But yeah, like they give humans the ability to like look at the world through the cameras and like basically at any point in human history. And it answers a lot of really difficult questions surrounding like religion, for example. And I think that like doing something like that might be really interesting, like the ethical, moral, and all the other questions that arise when you deal with like, hey, we're able to cross death is really cool to me.
I think some basic questions we'll have to ask is, according to what you're saying, a glimpse into the beyond the living. Like, are we talking about being able to know what happens after you die, or are we talking about like physically going to a place where presumably our souls are? So that also raises some other questions, because if this is science fiction, right? That means that souls and the afterlife and all that are material things. Like there are things governed by rules we may or may not understand yet, but they're scientific things.
Mm. Yeah. No, I was picturing it as either and or both of those, I guess. Like picturing a ship or some device that allows a crew or even a single person to venture off. Could even be kind of Contact-esque, which I know is like your favorite movie.
Interesting. So it's like we've developed some sort of device that takes us to the place that people go to when they die. That's the basic premise we're saying.
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, the other approach that I was thinking, if we were trying to be a little bit harder with the sci-fi, we could deal with like psychical impressions or echoes or something like that. But I like the idea that we have like a River Styx or a Mount Olympus, where it's like, nah, there's a physical place where people go when they die. But then that raises so many questions about that. And yeah, okay. Interesting.
Like it could also be like another, you know, dimension or plane of being that for some process you are able to like access somehow.
I mean, I guess it raises questions about the soul and our mind. Like yeah. In this realm, since you're suggesting another like reality or perhaps another universe, right? Physical universe. You know, mm-hmm. is it questions of like, do we exist in two places at once? So, for example, when we're alive, is there a part of ourselves that exists in a higher dimensional place, for example? Mm-hmm. Or maybe our minds technically are in a different place and they supervene on our bodies. And then when we die, they're separated. So that's one way to look at it, you know.
I like that. And I could imagine some like pseudo-scientific explanation that occurs during this plot of like, as a living being, you see everything just as one plane, but in reality, it's like two that are overlaid on top of each other. And we've figured out a way to like peel one off so that we can view it separately.
Yeah. So it's like maybe what this device does is you get into it and your body is basically killed, but instead of you, the other half of you, like, I don't know, going where it belongs, or I guess you having your consciousness in the other place, you're put in this device, which then can travel to that place. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That almost sounds like a teleporter. Like that it, wait, hold on. Can we just say that this is like a failed teleportation experiment? And this is like what happens when that process fails?
That would be interesting if they're trying to develop that. And the error is what created the splitting of the person. Like I could see like, they were developing a teleportation device and its intent was to dematerialize you, right? And then rematerialize you after transmitting you. But instead, it like killed the person. And then they're like, oh, fuck, it killed this person. But then there's a ghost like still around because it's the person on the other side trying to communicate with them. Mm-hmm. Like a poltergeist kind of deal. And then I guess they learned that this person has actually been separated from their body. And maybe they brought them back through the teleporter back into their body, and that scientist then worked on the device.
Yeah. See, that's really interesting because of all the implications regarding like the spirit, soul, and body connection. Like that's a really cool thing that we can explore.
Mm-hmm. I also think it would be interesting if when you go to the other place, like let's say when that person was separated in the first experiment, when he came back, he didn't have full knowledge of what happened over there. Maybe he only has like pieces of knowledge of it. And so that's why they have to do the experiment again to get more information as to what happened.
That's cool as shit, actually. This is just me thinking aesthetically. I'm thinking that the people who are in this, they're wearing something that looks like one of those 1920s diver suits, you know? So it's like, I've got to go into the death realm.
Maybe there's water involved, like the teleporter, you have to fill it with water to get in that
thing.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's sort of, okay, let's go. Yes.
Sort of like Leftovers-esque, I'm imagining.
Yeah.
That one scene that I can't talk about because it's spoilers.
Oh, but it's so fucking cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Damn you both.
there's another show that involves I think it's actually Stranger Things when she's doing her like mass telepathic stuff. She's put in like a vat of liquid.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I think it's salt water, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a deprivation tank thing.
Yeah, maybe it's like that where you have to create sensory deprivation in order to create the conditions for separating your soul from your body. And originally it was for teleporting.
Wait a minute. Have I talked on the podcast about my love for sensory deprivation tanks?
Probably a ways back, yeah.
Maybe a ways back, but I'm going to bring it up again. Y'all, if you can do a sensory deprivation tank, you should do it. It's really fucking cool. And honestly, I think that the parallels here work really well because after doing sensory deprivation tanks, I do certainly feel as though that the mind is purely shackled by the meat of the body. So I think that can also work to a certain extent as well. So I'm down for that. Yeah.
I mean, it might also be worth mentioning, because since it's supposed to be soft sci-fi too, like to talk about the differences between how we can conceive of like the material world, at least as far as philosophy is concerned. I mean, I know philosophy is not science, but it'll give us a perspective. Like ordinarily, science is based on a materialist view of the world. Everything is physical. there aren't really souls. There's consciousness. We don't know what that is, but if it is a thing, it's a material thing we can study. Everything's material, right? But the typical religious view of the world, the Christian one, is that there's the material world and there's souls, and souls are in this other place, and they are mystically connected to bodies, but they're completely separate. They're immaterial. But the other third thing, which is less talked about and is really what Judeo-Christian belief hinges on, is the idea of substance dualism, that there's a physical world and then there's an other physical world. Then that other physical world has things like the mind and the soul and things like that, and it supervenes on the body. So they're connected in some way, but they're different kinds of material. And it sounds like that's what we might be dealing with here, where there's this other place that the mind lives, and it's connected to the body by this magical thread, basically. But it's not like it's this immaterial realm. It's another kind of physical place.
Mm. Would it be something like limbo, or the equivalent of limbo to a certain extent?
As far as I understand substance dualism, it's a different kind of matter. If everything in the universe is matter and energy, you know, and there's another kind of substance that has different rules entirely and doesn't cross over with ours other than to connect the body to it as a mind.
Interesting. Okay. So I suppose my question then becomes, I feel like we've worked out roughly how the kind of moment of triumph in this kind of setting is looking so far. Like we've come up with the moment, right? And it's a significant moment. It's a great moment that allows us to explore a bunch of different topics. But I think what we should do is maybe zoom out just a little bit and explore what this moment of triumph has changed about the world to a certain extent.
Yeah. We could approach it like when this news first becomes publicized and that starts to change things. I'm not sure if I want to go the route of like, this was a small, you know, independent group that's been doing this study and they sort of discovered it by accident, or if it was some like major corporate thing or like government thing or some sort of like Star Trek utopia style world where everybody's working together and this happened and the technology is going to be shared openly. I guess it kind of depends on where we want to go with that.
My first inclination is to keep it very small and not a worldwide phenomenon, only because the story then becomes more about like, what are the consequences of using this technology rather than like, what are the character consequences? Like, I'm more interested in like a small group doing this on accident and then trying to figure out how to use it, and potentially the knowledge of it getting out can be dangerous.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I'm kind of in the same boat, Daniel, except I also imagine that if this technology were to be discovered in reality, I feel like no matter how big or small, there'd be an attempt to suppress the actual knowledge, right? Because it is literally world-changing on multiple levels. And so governmental agencies would probably want to keep that under wraps or maintain some level of control as they explore what the death realm actually is or does or looks like. I mean, the only way that I can kind of see this getting out is if like some tech billionaire bro like Elon Musk is like, all right, guys, today we're going to be showing off our newest teleportation technology, and then like does like a public demonstration, which, by the way, is like scarily plausible and like sadly plausible now that I say it like that. But I think that ultimately I'm more interested in keeping it, if not like to a small group, then like there's definitely governmental intervention happening with it as well.
There's also one of the things I liked about Contact, the movie in particular, because, you know, I haven't read the book, so I can't compare them, but the movie, there's a plausible deniability to it in that other than the recorded time of her being away, there's no proof that she went anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's part of the magic of, like, I think the narrative in that one, because for her, it's sort of a spiritual experience. And so I wonder in this one too, you know, given that you come back without knowledge of where you were, and I don't know what the imperfect knowledge you come back with is. I assume there's something, you know, having returned. My guess is it's probably like when you get separated like this, right? You come back with like dream information. Just as you would wake up from a dream, you don't remember it perfectly. Mm-hmm. So imagining that's what you come back with, because your mind and your body, as we're establishing this off sci-fi, is a thing that's out there and it experiences stuff that happens when you're separated from your body. But I'm guessing once you're put back in your body, that knowledge gets cloudy. And that's what I'm assuming they're really working on, trying to figure out if we keep doing this, can we get more perfect knowledge of what's happening when we're out there? And that might have some negative consequences.
Yeah. And also, like, I'm picturing now, like, a group of kids or, like, college students being the one to do this. Like, they're obviously very intelligent, and, like, maybe there's a competition for some sort of grant. So they're trying to create this teleportation device, and things go wrong. And that also adds to, like, the lack of credibility, potentially, if they were to present these findings. Like, are people really going to trust, like, a bunch of teenagers or, you know, college 20-somethings? Yeah.
Oh, my God, we're recreating Flatliners, because it's, like, medical students, I think.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I'm thinking is that, like, we can have this be self-propelled. You know, like, maybe they're like, no one's going to believe us. We need more data. So we need to push further into the thing, right? And it's like, I think, Daniel, you're absolutely spot on. Let's keep it, like, small and tight. And, like, maybe have Kevin Bacon in there, some Kiefer Sutherland, you know. Shit, no, this is Flatliners. Damn.
When your government guy could be the funding, like Courtney's saying, maybe there's, like, an individual funder, and this person is shady, right? Like, perhaps they have a sense of what's going on, but they want to let these kids go as far as they can and keep it quiet, because if they can pull it off, then they can, like, silence these kids and take the research.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And it kind of has this, like, I don't know, Steven Spielberg, like, 80s, 90s kid adventure movie vibe to it that I'm imagining anyway.
I've got, like, a real Lost Boys vibe to this for some reason, you know, where it's like...
I've never seen that one, actually.
Oh, interesting. I feel like you'd like that. Well, part of it anyway, until the children get involved, but, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Here's what I'm thinking, though. I think that we're on the right track, but I think that there has to be something tangible that they can experience. And I think Daniel was kind of hinting at it too, or like that fogginess, that kind of cloudiness, like what happens when they enter that realm that they come back with, like, dude, you got to try that. Or dude, we got to go back and figure out more, you know, like there's something that's got to be there that entices them to explore further.
I feel like they come back with something that is revelatory. Now, I don't know if that's expressed as an ability or if it's expressed as knowledge, but they come back with something that is obviously impossible for them to know. So maybe it's impossible knowledge.
I think I would prefer something intangible, because I think that's way more interesting. Like if they came back and they're like, dude, I know Kung Fu now, or like something like that. That's like, oh, I've got super speed. Like that's way less interesting to me than something like, so I had a conversation with Galileo and it turns out, you know, like something like that, like the ability to speak to a dead entity and come back with that conversational knowledge is really interesting to me.
That's what I was thinking too, like make it more, even more of a personal conversation, like the person is brought back and, you know, they're having a meal after with the group or something. And like, oh yeah, by the way, like I ran into your mom and she says hello and like, asked a question about like something and the other kid is like, my mom's been dead for like 10 years.
And they don't know, like they can't distinguish between what knowledge from the dead realm is and the living. Like it's confusing to them. I almost still want them to be able to like choose and pick things that are like, I want to talk to, you know, the guy who had a huge stock break so I could, you know, get some knowledge or whatever. I want it to be personal to them.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Like maybe it's more about the entities that seek them out than anything. Like the mother of the friend recognized this person because they were childhood friends. So like the mom remembers this kid coming over and wanted to say hi because she hasn't seen him in 10 years or something.
Mm-hmm. And I can't distinguish between that being a dream they remembered versus happening. Yeah.
Ooh. Okay. So because I'm thinking about how they want to try and push this further, right? I love the idea that it is stuck or it is very much entrenched in who you know or who you remember, right? Like, oh, this person knew that person's mom. So they're able to like manifest that or like think about that or talk to them. But what if like in order for them to push it further to try and like have more specificity or find the person that they're trying to talk to, it's kind of like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, where it's like, hey mom, can I talk to grandma? And then your grandma can apparate or something like that. And so like you can talk to specific people through like chains of different like ancestors or people that they are familiar with or intimate with. That to me, I think is kind of an interesting way, but I like what you're saying, Daniel, where you want it to be impossible or very difficult to control. So maybe there's some way that, you know, like you meet a random soul, but there is a possibility of you chaining the conversation to someone else. And that's a way that we can explore the kind of realm of death further.
Yeah, I think there's like a certain there's a certain uncertainty to it. And I think what would happen in is like, if you're crafting this as a story, it becomes less about death and what's on the other side and more about the things that make you who you are. Mm-hmm. The things in your life that you lost and that others have lost are suddenly kind of bleeding into everyone in this group. And I, you know, I have a feeling we're fucking recreating Flatliners. I don't remember the exact, I don't remember the plot of it at all, but, and I have a feeling this is exactly what happened with them. But I feel like this group, the more they go back, the more their pasts, which are really the realm of the dead, are bleeding into each other, you know, and that can be probably very bad.
Yeah. I also kind of get arrival vibes from it, where like the past and present and death is all interconnected and they stop being able to tell the difference between things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So love that idea for sure. And I think that what we do is we leave it at this kind of point where what matters is the interpersonal connections between those characters as they're all trying to like go in this machine and like figure out this kind of death realm, so to speak. And I think that by doing that, like leaving it up to the interpersonal communications, like leaves it messy, but also that's where like a lot of the character growth can happen. And I think that we simply don't have time enough to do that on a jam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like if we were developing this further, we give ourselves more prompts to
tease
out, you know, how that knowledge breaks down and causes problems, you know?
Oh yeah. Like you're going to get like imperfect knowledge or knowledge that is just specific to them to a certain extent.
Or even knowledge of the future. To Courtney's point, like if in the realm of the dead, time isn't the same, like there's not a sense of past, present and future progression. In the realm of the dead, you become conscious of both the future and the present, because in the past, they're all the same. Then you could come back and bleed knowledge about the future, which could be very frightening, you know, like. Maybe you encounter someone in the living that you know is dead now based on your inclinations. So it's like, well, they'll be dead. And so you have a sense of like when they will die. And then that could be an interesting concept.
Okay, that's fucking with my head just a little bit too much, which means that I think it's time for us to move on to the next jam. So unless you guys have anything else to say about this particular world, I'm ready to move on. How about you?
Just that last thing that Daniel said makes me think that like the ending, if this were to be a story or a total not ripoff of Flatliners movie, like the government agent is clearly onto them and is like about to, you know, steal their technology or something. But for some reason, the group is totally unconcerned. And it turns out that like they know that he's just going to like die very soon and he won't be able to share the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's like, you're going to die of a heart attack like now. So we're not even that concerned about it. That's okay. That's fucking sinister though. You realize that that's fucking sinister, right? Like Jesus Christ.
Well, I mean, there's a couple ways too. You could run that. Like you could also have it be that like they're coming to grips with what they know. Right. And there is a struggle and it gets really tough, but one of them kind of has a vision of different ways it can go. And one of the ways it can go is like, one of them realizes, oh, he ends up almost killing this person, but then he has a heart attack, but they don't know that exactly. Cause it's kind of like dreamlike knowledge, right? So mm-hmm, there can be like a fear as to how this is going to pan out. But in the end, they saw how it's going to pan out. They just don't realize it yet. So it'd be really interesting to shoot it if it were a film, right? Because you could show clips from the end of it in a way that are not understood until you get moments before it. Mm-hmm. Almost like a memento sort of thing where you can reorder the way things happen based on their imperfect knowledge. And that'd be kind of cool, like in terms of the structure of the narrative.
Yeah, I'm also getting like a weird 12 Monkeys vibe from this for some reason.
Yeah.
Just like in terms of like the non-linearity of the story and stuff like that. But
I also haven't seen that, which I know
we gotta watch that one. I think we like that.
I was gonna say, I swear that we've watched it. Oh, you know, we watched Alphaville, which is like the French like inspiration for their 12 Monkeys. Is it 13 or 12 Monkeys? I can't remember. It's a certain number of monkeys.
I think it's 12 Monkeys right now.
Yeah, it's 12.
Okay. I don't know why. I must be Bernstein Bearsing myself over here. Anyway, okay. Let's move on to the next and final jam. So our genre for this time is going to be... we've got climate fiction, y'all. So I imagine this is where Daniel comes in and explains the differentiation between climate fiction. What do you got for us, Daniel?
So in our list of genres, they're kind of a flattened list of what would really be a bunch of umbrellas. But climate fiction tends to be under, I mean, as far as I can see, a lot of the novels tend to be under some kind of dystopian or apocalyptic fiction. So it's usually a category of science fiction, but you could easily do climate fiction that is styled fantasy. You could do one as a mystery. You could do one as alternate history. Those are all possible, but the idea is the focus is on climate change, basically.
Interesting. So let's go ahead and find out what we're dealing with our theme. And our theme this time is going to be the mundane. Okay. So we've got climate fiction, the mundane, and our focus is going to be. Oh, this is a, I don't think we've ever gotten this combination before, but this is really interesting. So the focus is a rebellion slash revolution. The theme is the mundane and the genre is climate fiction. So Courtney started us off last time. Daniel, I think it's only fair that you start us off this time. What do you got for climate fiction surrounding the mundane while we're focusing on a revolution or rebellion?
My first vague thought goes to some kind of social unrest going on since it's mundane, and maybe that social unrest is adjacent to climate problems that are occurring. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be the basis for any kind of genre, because we haven't really said like what kind of genre this is in terms of fantasy versus sci-fi or whatever. But I'm thinking something where you're on the ground in the midst of some kind of social unrest, which results in revolutionary action, and the climate is part of the cause.
Yeah, like right away, it made me think of The Water Knife, which is a book about like a near future where the states, especially in out west, are like fighting over water rights for, you know, the Colorado River and so on. And it mostly takes place in Phoenix. And one of the three characters it follows is a journalist who has stayed out there to cover what's happening out there. But there are parts where it's just the process of getting water and how it has to be rationed and the sort of mundane day-to-day things that people go through. And I mean, there's obviously a lot more to it than that, but it is very like on the ground in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly a direction that we can go in with water rights, or we could do something with storms as a backdrop, migration, anything really.
I mean, what would really be interesting too, along these lines, is if we take something like water rights, but we replace it with something fantastical or speculative so that we can speak to the issues of climate change metaphorically. So like, for example, if instead of water rights, you had, I don't know, the rights to make utterances, something absurd and very speculative. You know, you could speak about scarcity, and then what does scarcity mean without making it an overt climate fiction story? I mean, and we can do that too, but I'm just thinking like that would be a way to talk around it, but also have the speculative element.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if we wanted to keep it more literal in terms of climate, I'm also thinking about like meat consumption, I think is an interesting way to kind of talk about it as well, because there's so many conservative memes of like, they're going to make us eat bugs and, you know, like they're coming for our hamburgers and stuff like that. And I feel like, honestly, that's a potentially interesting story to focus on meat consumption, which is like, so take it for granted, much like water rights are, right? Water and meat consumption are such an obvious, like blatant and mundane thing that I imagine that we're looking at this thing, a rebellion over this is the last cow in existence, or maybe there's the return of the cowboy or the return of the bandito or something like that. There might be something there as well.
Well, the most commonly consumed animal is a chicken. Imagine if there was no poultry in the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've got like the avian flu that's sort of looming in the background right now.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah.
Maybe like something makes it, you know, toxic or impossible to eat that anymore. And you see the collapse of all whole kinds of economies as a result.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is almost the background of the comic Chew, by the way. In Chew, like, the chicken gets mysteriously banned and people eventually develop food-based powers. Like, the main character is able to eat something and then have psychic visions about that thing's history, which leads to him eating all sorts of weird shit, obviously. But I think that starting with chickens is a good way to start, because you're also destroying eggs at that point, which means that you're destroying multiple industries, not just like steak and beef, right?
Yeah, fish is another opportunity too, especially with, like, I mean, there is kind of a growing scarcity of fish that we're seeing now too.
So is this entire genre just designed to bum us out, Daniel? Because it sounds like it sounds like this genre is just here to make me sad.
Well, I mean, like, a lot of these, you know, if you look at the list of books that are in the genre, they tend to be cautionary tales, and that's why they tend to be in science fiction. The one thing I worry about with that, in terms of jamming on this, is, you know, our podcast is about speculative fiction at the end of the day. So what's the speculative part of this? And I think it has to be more than, like, something caused all the chickens to die, right? Because that's just kind of boring.
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, maybe if we do some sort of, like, fantastical ecology type of thing, like, could even be a group of fantasy explorers, adventurers going to a new place and discovering things, but also seeing how industry in the other parts of the world have degraded this place, even though it's undiscovered as of yet, or something to that effect, where it's like, you know, the dragon eggs are not hatching like they used to, or griffins aren't sprouting feathers sufficient enough to give them flight, and so on.
So are these adventurers venturing out because something is happening in their realm that's been caused by a change of climate to some place that has solved this problem to possibly get stuff? So for your example, like, XYZ animal they deal with normally is in peril because of climate change. So adventurers have left to someplace else that has solved this problem. And then they're going there creates problems for themselves and for others.
Yeah, we could make some sort of like dragon riders group or something where they, you know, their dragons are suffering due to whatever effect of climate change, whether it's their food source is lacking or the magic is being sucked out of the world or who knows. And that keeps pushing the fantastical element, and, you know, they're able to fly someplace far off that normally wouldn't be reachable.
You know, I've always been a fan of, like, the dragon as a walking apocalypse. And I like the idea that there is a sense of dragon riders, but they don't understand that those dragons merely existing are dramatically altering how the ecosystem functions. And maybe we can do something like with that, you know, like, dragons usually represent greed and the hoarding of wealth. And what better way to represent and update that kind of trope by suggesting that the existence of dragons is demonstrably ruining the ecosystem, like, rapidly.
Or it's like they were meant to be rare apex predators, but were tamed and bred to be part of this army or something. And then obviously they need enormous amounts of food to survive because they're massive apocalypses, like you said. So it could be something like that, where something that our, like, heroes culture views as the norm is actually something that they've pushed onto nature and is not going so well.
So that's why they're venturing out to find other sources of food from other kingdoms, or potentially.
Yeah, it could be something like that. Them. yeah.
I love the idea that, like, I want to keep the dragon rider aspect, right? Like, I love the idea that there's this heroic kingdom who are renowned for their dragon riders. Like, that is, like, apex hero shit, right? And maybe even royalty a la so many other fictions. But I also like the idea that there are these rebellions and uprisings that need to be put down. And people are like, what's going on with these rebellions? Why are they so against this particular empire? And then, you know, it's about the heroes recognizing that the very dragons they ride are the root cause of, like, the famines that are sparking and spurring these rebellions forward. And it's kind of this reconciliation with the power that they have, and also, like, the renown and the wealth and everything. Like, I think there could be a really interesting character story in there.
the one thing I don't want to lose sight of is the prompts requirement that this is mundane. So yeah. Even though we've introduced dragon riders and dragons, I wonder though, you know, does that mean we leave the dragons behind in the backdrop and these people are traveling not by flying because they're too sick to fly by foot into some other place? And then it becomes more about these more material concerns between them and solving the problem.
Oh, I see. So it might even not be like the dragon riders themselves who are traveling, or maybe it's just like one or two as representatives, but mostly it's like some sort of mundane adventuring group that was contracted to do this, maybe like scouting out areas.
I can see some riders with them, like you're saying, but they can't bring their dragons because the dragons are too ill.
Yeah. That's interesting. And then to like be able to see all the unrest literally on the ground, whereas previously the dragon riders obviously kind of only saw from the sky and also like from their nobility.
Because they're noble.
That's the thing. That's the theme. It's forced mundanity. It's like, I've only been able to see the world from on high, and now that I'm forced to walk it, it's a completely like life altering experience. Yeah, that totally works, Courtney. Yeah.
And so when they go to this other place, I mean, they could even, the unrest could be maybe not even in their kingdom. Maybe they go to this other place, they experience where the unrest is. That's entirely possible too.
Yeah.
Well, it could even be like, I mean, I guess this is in a way getting away from climate and more into after effects of war, but it could be like another land that they recently conquered using their dragons, but they get to see like on the ground the after effects of that, which would of course affect the climate of these areas. If you know, you scorch the plains and the forests and everything, like that's going to dramatically fuck up everything for the people living there.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
And let's also not lose sight of the fact that climate change causes war as well, you know? So like the idea that continued use of these dragons is also accelerating, you know, warfare, or, you know, the undercurrents that cause warfare. That's also a really interesting way that we kind of approach it as well.
Yeah. Like maybe that's why this war even started, was like, they wanted to get at the cattle herds or sheep herds or whatever in this territory. And that's like mainly what they were after, or some other like major food source.
Well, I think that this is a really cool thing. I think one thing that I'm missing is a little bit of a conflict, but I also feel like I want to roll some dice and figure out a twist. How do y'all feel about that?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sure. I do feel like a lot of the conflict would be like internal and through just discussion as these people see like the damage they've done to the environment and to the people.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's definitely a character study almost. It's like, oh, it's this internal conflict or interpersonal conflict, you know, as there's that clash of ideals, like reckoning with what they've become and what they've done as well. But like I said, I think rolling some dice and finding a twist would help us keep that in focus. And so let's roll a twist for today's episode. Our twist this time is: on second thought, make it a happy ending. Okay. All right, Courtney, now is your time to solve climate change. Go.
Oh, gosh. The dragon riders learn that they need to spay and neuter their dragons.
thank God we have Bob of the House Barker there to help everyone with that.
I don't know exactly, but like, I think it would have to come with at least some of the dragon riders realizing that it's no longer sustainable. Like they basically have to let these tamed versions of dragons die out in the long run, you know, not to like immediately go back home and murder them, but like just the lineage has to die off in order for it to kind of return to normalcy.
Okay, wait, this isn't necessarily happy, but I'm also thinking of like, it's happy for the world, but maybe this walk is like the final walk that he's taking after the death of, because they recognize the insustainability, or maybe these dragons are just like dying off on their own or something like that. And it is like this walk that is not just one of, you know, mundane drudgery, but one that is, I'm thinking Remains of the Day, if y'all know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm getting that, where like you just have this very noble dragon rider taking this long walk to reflect upon his life as someone who is viewed as a hero, and then also encountering all the things that they never encountered because they were on the back of a dragon the entire time.
Yeah. That book is devastating, by the way. I would highly recommend people check it out.
Shit, it's quietly devastating, yes. Though. That's what I love about it. That book is, Courtney, you're spot on. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I like that. And I could even see like bringing, I know it's, you know, mundane, but bringing some amount of a fantastical element into it by maybe this dragon rider's dragon had died, but like he has an egg or a recent hatchling from its last brood that he has with him as he's like trying to search for a cure or something, just to like, I don't know, add that element in that he's caring for this thing while also seeing the devastation that it can have once it's fully grown.
I think you have to do something too in the end that puts things back. It's almost like giving that egg away to, I don't know, someplace in nature. Something that like you can come back from once you've done it. Because we're talking about undomesticating. Yeah. So it means letting the ones you have domesticated die off, but then like not having interaction again with the dragon world. I mean, then maybe that's what it is. Doing something that makes it either impossible or extremely generationally difficult to have future interactions with the dragons.
Yeah.
Imagine if you wanted to undomesticate dogs, right? You'd have to kill all the pets first. And you'd have to isolate the wild dogs from humans so that for several generations they become feral again.
Yeah.
Daniel, that's fucking brilliant. I love that. Because these are seafaring creatures, like why not just like exile them to some island or some incredibly difficult to get to like faraway land? And then that way, like this journey back, maybe it's like by boat. And then maybe it's the walk from the pier or something like that. Something that's like humans can get there, but you can't really get there except through this extremely long and difficult journey. But as I say that, I recognize that they can still get there and people will still probably try and do that. So
I mean, complicated. Maybe the dragon rider takes the last of the dragons that can fly and flies up there and doesn't come back, you know?
Yeah.
Oh,
I like that. Yeah.
And so like that's the hero of the story, but we're not following the hero of the story. We're following the people on the ground, the dragon riders who were effectively abandoned by their brood. And so it's about their story. Oh, you can do this as like a series of like characters who are reflecting on all of these things. And like some take the walk and they remain pissed. Some take the walk and recognize that it's actually a good thing. And some take the walk and third option. But like, I think that's a really good way that you can explore all of these angles of this particular thing. And also like their interpersonal relationships with that quote unquote hero dragon rider who's taking them all away.
Yeah. I mean, I think as a novel, you could have multiple points of view. One could be this dragon rider, maybe throughout the whole progress of the novel is going to go abandon that dragon, but you don't really realize what he's doing until the end of the novel. And then throughout it follows the people, like you're saying, on the ground who are part of this conflict, visiting the devastated place. So you're learning about the situation from multiple points of view. And then by the end of it, you have the satisfying delivery of the final dragon and the dragon rider never returning.
Exactly. Yeah,
I could also see like I talked about before, maybe this dragon rider has an egg or hatchling or something. Like maybe it is actually his dragon that he's ridden in the past, but it's like so old and sickly now that it's just walking alongside of him as this like lumbering thing, but it can't really do anything anymore. It's more of like a symbol at this point. And then towards the end, maybe they just disappear from camp one day and the people that have been traveling with them come to realize like, oh, he took it away forever. That was his final choice.
You could go real dark too. You have him get to the edge of where the continent is, these things come from, and the thing can't fly or climb anymore. Mm-hmm. And he leaves it to die, climbs up the mountain with the egg, and doesn't come back.
Yeah.
See, I was thinking that you could have the elderly dragon. They're like, you know what? We'll let you keep that one, you know, because it can't breed. It's like too old for war. So we'll let you keep it. And then it like basically dies at the end of the journey, signaling the end of the age of the dragon as well. Right. Like you could do it that way as well.
Yeah. I do like the image though of him like flying off and the group doesn't ever know exactly what happens, but maybe as like the novel or whatever, you see that he does reach there and then goes off into the mist.
Yeah. I do like the idea that the hero has left the group and then it's like the fallout of that as they like walk back, basically. Like that's a cool premise to go with for sure. And also like, I love the idea. It's like, oh yeah, that was the hero who mysteriously vanished, like not knowing that he made a heroic sacrifice to save the rest of the fucking world, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like they think he just like ran off one day.
Or like he was supposed to do some heroic deed and then died mysteriously there or something happened to him, right? Like you can martyr him if you really wanted to. It's a legend, you know? Legends tend to do that.
We have lots of options, I think. But it seems the shape of the thing is pretty clear that you want to tell. We want to tell a story about the people who had this exalted position and the people who are affected by it. And that's something that I think climate change as a genre speaks to. There are the people who are affected by climate change, and then there's the people who aren't, who are too wealthy and they're insulated by it. And so this is reflected in the story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it's a perfect story to end on as we close out our jam.
Nice and uplifting.
I mean, it's a happy ending in the sense that the world doesn't end, I guess, right? Like it says happy, not uplifting. So I feel like we nailed it, you know? All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of World Build with Us. I always enjoy my jam sessions. This was a very fun one. Very, very down to earth, these two, I feel, right? Like they both feel very grounded in reality, in some cases literally grounded because, you know, they're not riding dragons anymore. But I very much enjoyed it. Great to be back. And remember that if you want us to build your world, you can always go to our website, worldbuildwithus.com, where you can click the link, follow some instructions, and within a reasonable amount of time, we'll be building your world. If you want to follow us on social media, you can subscribe to us on YouTube, or you can follow us on Twitter. And if you want to come talk to us more directly, you can join our Discord with a link for that in the description. Or if you're feeling particularly generous or just want access to sweet, sweet patron-only goodies, we've got a Patreon where you can thank us and support the podcast there. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of World Build with Us. Remember that we love you very much. We're going to get through this together. Until next week.